Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Fire and Rain, Nixon, Kissinger, and the Wars in Southeast Asia, by Carolyn Woods Eisenberg, narrated by Susan Erickson. Introduction. This is not frivolous, Mr. Chairman. It was viewed as an awesome responsibility. For members of the House Judiciary Committee, whatever they had said about Richard Nixon in the past, whether in anger or in admiration, a decision to approve articles of impeachment weighed heavily. If approved, it would go to the full House of Representatives for a vote. And if the vote was in favor of impeachment, then the U.S. Senate would decide whether the president was guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors. While theirs was only the first step in the process, members of the Judiciary Committee had strong reasons to believe that what they collectively decided could determine the fate of the President of the United States. More than a century had passed since the last time Congress had entertained such a possibility, and it was no small thing to unseat a president, especially Richard Nixon, who in his re-election effort had carried every state in the Union but one. From May 9th through July 30th, 1974, the committee, consisting of 36 men and 2 women, pored over books of documents, questioned witnesses, weighed the arguments of counsel, and debated with one another. Its chairman, Democrat Peter Rodino, wanted to focus on the first 3 articles of impeachment. Seeking to minimize party divisions, he believed those to be the most likely to find some measure of bipartisan support. Each of these 3 articles pertained to domestic crimes linked in some fashion to the Watergate break-in and subsequent investigations. Since June of 1972, when 7 men were arrested for illegally entering the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee in the Watergate Hotel, there had been a steady drip and then a flood of revelations about the administration's misuse of power. This break-in, which seemed inexplicable on the surface, had been executed by a plumbers group connected to the White House and specifically to the Committee to Re-elect the President, CREEP. The plumbers, it emerged, had been responsible for illegal eavesdropping, burglaries, intimidation, and dirty tricks. Because the connection to the White House would be so damaging to Nixon if it came to light, there had been a wide-ranging cover-up designed to insulate him from the crime. During the 1972 election season, White House lawyer John Dean had successfully managed this task. However, since the inauguration, the official story had steadily unraveled, and by the spring, Dean himself had become a hostile witness. Over the course of the following year, more details had emerged about the administration's illegal efforts to suppress this and other scandals. By the time the House Judiciary Committee convened, key members of the president's team were facing felony charges, among them former Chief of Staff H.R. Bob Haldeman, Assistant to the President John Ehrlichman, Special Counsel Chuck Colson, and former Attorney General John Mitchell. Given the weight of evidence, it was no surprise that a majority of the committee voted in favor of the first 3 articles. Article 1, which accused the president of personally acting to obstruct justice in the Watergate case. Article 2, charging him with persistent misuse of his authority in upholding the country's laws. And Article 3, faulting him for defying subpoenas of his records and withholding other evidence pertinent to the impeachment process. With their passage, It became unlikely that Richard Nixon would finish out his term of office. Cast into oblivion were two other articles of impeachment, which were rejected by a majority on the committee. One of these had relatively narrow significance, the accusation that the president had underpaid federal income tax and accepted government financing of improvements to his personal homes. But Article 4 had a much wider reach and sparked intense debate among committee members. Introduced by Representative John Conyers of Michigan, it charged the president with the submission to the Congress of false and misleading statements concerning the evidence, scope, and nature of American bombing operations in Cambodia in derogation of the power of the Congress to declare war, to make appropriations, and to raise and support armies. For some Americans, any reference to Cambodia could evoke deep emotions. The uproar surrounding the president's decision to send troops in April 1970 had produced the largest anti-war protest of Nixon's first term, culminating in an explosion of dissent and some violence on college campuses, most memorably, the shooting and deaths of four students at Kent State University. The U.S. invasion of Cambodia, which had been publicly announced, was not the primary focus of the proposed article. Instead, it was the 14 months of covert bombing of Cambodia that Nixon had ordered prior to the ground invasion. During this period, B-52 bombers had launched 3,695 attacks on that country, despite the president's repeated insistence that the United States had never intervened there prior to the invasion. The dishonesty of that claim had only garnered attention in July 1973, when retired Major Hal Knight testified to the Senate Armed Services Committee that in his capacity as supervisor of radar crews in South Vietnam, he had helped falsify the flight records of at least 24 missions by disguising American airstrikes in Cambodia as attacks inside South Vietnam. In an elaborate arrangement, the real coordinates for the planes were hand-delivered to Knight by a courier from General Creighton Abrams' headquarters in Saigon and then given to the pilots. Once the flights returned, there was a dual system of reporting in which fake information was entered into the Pentagon computers while Knight would gather and burn the incriminating documents. To signify a successful mission, he would place a call and report to an anonymous official in Saigon, "The ball game is over." The Senate Armed Services Committee quickly learned that Knight's experience was part of a larger pattern of falsifying records to hide the bombing of Cambodia from the American public and from Congress. So far-reaching was the secrecy surrounding this undeclared war that even the civilian secretary of the Air Force, Robert Seaman, was not informed. Who had orchestrated the elaborate system of deception? In the aftermath of Knight's testimony, many wished to know. However, one thing was clear. President Nixon had ordered both the bombing and its concealment. By doing so, he had effectively denied members of Congress the opportunity to debate or vote on whether to authorize this military action in an officially neutral country. Unlike the other charges the Judiciary Committee had considered, the veracity of the Cambodia charge was not disputed. Whatever the motive, the Nixon administration had clearly deceived Congress with the intent to sidestep its prerogative to declare war and appropriate funds for that purpose. Conyers wanted the Judiciary Committee to reaffirm that legislative responsibility. Many people don't know or have forgotten that the Congress constitutionally has that sole authority. And so, I would urge that we, in an attempt to reassert those powers which we consider vital and precious, if the constitutional form of government is to prevail and continue and improve, that we give the gravest consideration to this article. He also contended that it was the desire to hide the bombing that had led to the unparalleled use of wiretaps and illegal surveillance of journalists and government officials. The congressman was referring to events prompted by a May 1969 New York Times article in which Pentagon correspondent William Beecher reported that American B-52s had struck Viet Cong and North Vietnamese supply dumps in Cambodia. This story had gone nowhere, but had nonetheless infuriated Nixon and Kissinger. So eager were they to identify those who had leaked the story to Beecher that, at their behest, the FBI had placed warrantless wiretaps on 13 government officials, several of whom were on Kissinger's staff, and on 4 members of the press. In Conyers' view, this was the beginning of a policy of corruption that had gone on for years. While he had limited his proposed article of impeachment to the specific lies about Cambodia and the resulting wiretaps, John Conyers saw a direct link between the crimes of Watergate and the administration's lawless conduct of the Vietnam War. 2 years earlier, when the Nixon administration had resumed the bombing of North Vietnam and begun the mining of Haiphong Harbor, Conyers and several colleagues had taken out a 2-page ad in the New York Times arguing that these were impeachable offenses. Partly for this reason, Chairman Rodino and some other Democrats on the Judiciary Committee were worried about Article 4. In their view, drawing too tight a connection between the process of impeachment and opposition to the Vietnam War would be needlessly divisive at a time when they were seeking consensus. Father Robert Drynan, anti-war congressman from Massachusetts and a Jesuit priest, objected to this reasoning. He did not believe the process for picking articles of impeachment should be influenced by whether they will fly, rather than by the gravity of the infraction. The Founding Fathers had recognized that the ultimate tyranny was war carried on illegally by the executive without the knowledge or consent of Congress. Yet many on the committee did not agree. As Ohio's Republican Congressman Delbert Lotta stated, "This was a time of war, when inevitably things happen that you don't put on the front page of every newspaper." Nixon's overriding concern had been to protect American troops and bring them home safely. To the extent that action in Cambodia had contributed to that result, this was a reason for gratitude. Few of Lotta's Republican colleagues went that far, but several maintained that there was shared culpability for the congressional violations that had occurred during the Vietnam War, and that it was unfair to single out President Nixon. Moreover, it was not only Republicans who had objected to Conyers' article. Representative Walter Flowers, Democrat from Alabama, thought President Nixon was getting a bad rap on this matter. "We might as well resurrect President Lyndon Johnson and impeach him posthumously for Vietnam and Laos." For John Conyers and his newly elected colleague, Elizabeth Holtzman, Democrat from New York, getting Article 4 on the agenda had been an uphill struggle. In allocating staff resources, opportunity for debate, even access to primetime television, the committee chair had sought to marginalize their concern. Up through the final day of the proceedings, Rodino had pressured the Detroit congressman to drop it. Yet Conyers stood by Article 4, maintaining, "This is not frivolous, Mr. Chairman." Even those who understood the seriousness of the issue Conyers raised in Article 4 did not necessarily want to proceed with it. John Seiberling, who represented the Ohio District of Kent State, acknowledged that the issue is the falsification of information, the misleading of Congress, the failure to consult Congress on a matter as grave as an act of war. In his view, four students had died because the President of the United States again abused his power and again invaded Cambodia without consulting the Congress. Such behavior was reprehensible and must not be tolerated in the future, yet Seiberling contended, "We should not use our impeachment power to impeach Nixon for acts of the sort other presidents have taken with impunity, and for which the Congress bears a very deep measure of responsibility." Proposing to exonerate the president on the grounds that his predecessors had engaged in similar behavior and that past members of Congress had been indulgent was a curious line of argument. For those who supported Article 4, however, it seemed clear that it was more important to establish a precedent for punishing any violation of Congress's constitutional right and responsibility to make decisions about going to war. Congressman Wayne Owens of Utah expressed his hope that we will set down a standard for presidents and future wars, that something positive will come out of the history of this sad war in Southeast Asia and the history of this sad proceeding. In subsequent years, perhaps the American people, acting through their elected representatives, would openly decide questions of war and peace, just like the Constitution requires. Conyers, Holtzman, and several others on the Judiciary Committee considered that secretly bombing a neutral country 3,600 times and lying to Congress about it was so egregious that Article 4 article should be approved so that the entire body of the House could vote on it. Nonetheless, when the roll was called, every Republican voted against it, as did 9 of their Democratic colleagues. While members of the Judiciary Committee were casting their historic votes, the New York Times published a set of articles by Sidney Shanberg, who was reporting on the ground in Cambodia. 5 years after President Nixon had ordered the bombing of that country, and 4.5 years after the overthrow of its head of state, Prince Sihanouk, Cambodia was ravaged by the civil war that had resulted from those events. Writing from the town of Udon, Shanberg described the aftermath of a battle between the government and the brutal insurgents known as the Khmer Rouge. Forests have been mowed down. Schools, pagodas, mosques, and hospitals have been flattened. The same was true of nearby towns, Prek Kdam and Kompong Luang, and the villages in between. Many of the 20,000 inhabitants of Udong were captured by the rebels when they retreated into the jungle. The rest had escaped to the capital of Phnom Penh. Shanberg described the appalling conditions in this once beautiful capital city. Thousands of homeless children roamed its streets, begging for food. 5 years earlier, Phnom Penh had a population of 600,000, but the mass arrival of refugees had swelled that number to more than 2 million, vastly exceeding the capacity of the residents to absorb them. Some have wood or plastic as lean-to covers to keep off the weather, and some have straw mats to lie on. Others simply live in the open, sleeping in their dirty, tattered clothes on pieces of cardboard. Garbage is often piled nearby, and rats occasionally slither over sleepers. Illness was naturally on the increase. In addition to dysentery and tuberculosis, refugees had a common vitamin deficiency called SPOK, which caused a progressive loss of sensation in feet and legs until the person could no longer walk. With political events of such magnitude occurring in Washington, few people were focused on events in Udang, Pred Kedam, Kampong Luang, or even Phnom Penh. Ignoring the life-altering consequences of America's war in Southeast Asia was not unusual for Americans. In voting down Article 4, the members of the Judiciary Committee effectively sanctioned that willful ignorance and denial and ensured that President Nixon would not face responsibility for the tragic events his invasion had set in motion. All the articles of impeachment that would be brought before the House were connected to the domestic crimes brought to light by Watergate. This meant that constitutional issues of the gravest importance would be overlooked in any impeachment proceeding. During June 1974, one of America's foremost historians, Henry Steele Commager, had warned against obscuring the deeper constitutional issues that were raised by the administration's misconduct. Nixon had already won a strategic victory, he wrote, in the realm of public and perhaps even of congressional opinion by successfully concentrating attention on Watergate and its associated chicaneries. The minority on the Judiciary Committee, who registered their dissent over the exclusion of Article 4, expressed similar concerns. By failing to recommend the impeachment of President Nixon for the deception of Congress and the American public as to an issue as grave as the systematic bombing of a neutral country, we implicitly accept the argument that any ends, even those a president believes are legitimate, justify unconstitutional means. After the fact, one could reasonably argue that the particulars of the impeachment articles made no practical difference. What mattered was that the Judiciary Committee had found President Nixon guilty and unfit for office, and this finding had caused him to resign even before the House of Representatives could commence its deliberations. Yet by excluding foreign military activities from these articles, the committee framed how the events of that time have been remembered ever since. Although the illegal actions of Nixon's domestic officials were exposed, the role of National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger was effectively spared congressional scrutiny or critique. Shameful as the Watergate offenses were, they were hardly the most serious crimes, yet they have largely determined the public's historical understanding. The resulting amnesia has left intact many of the ideas, practices, and institutions that over decades have damaged the United States while inflicting needless suffering on foreign nations and people. Fire and Rain takes as its subject the Nixon administration's conduct of the war in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, and the resulting diplomacy with the Soviet Union and China. This reverses more familiar accounts, which assume that U.S. military actions in Southeast Asia were the consequence of Cold War fears of the communist superpowers. While that description is arguably relevant to earlier decision-making, it is profoundly misleading when applied to the Nixon years. In fact, the administration's mounting difficulties in solving its Vietnam problem increasingly shaped interactions with Moscow and Beijing. Inevitably, The actions and thoughts of President Nixon and his National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger, occupy a central place in this narrative. Given the already large and impressive literature on their conduct of foreign policy, an obvious question is why produce another study? The answer is paradoxical. On the one hand, the declassification of the extraordinary presidential tapes, along with the transcripts from thousands of Kissinger telephone calls, provides a close-up view of the two decision-makers that is without parallel in other administrations. On the other hand, the opportunity for this intense scrutiny has had the perverse effect of obscuring the role of other actors. To understand U.S. policy during this period requires situating Nixon and Kissinger within the wider context of the people, the social and political institutions, the prevailing ideology, and the existing practices that framed their decision-making. For all their distinctive qualities, both men were profoundly conventional in having reached their high positions by conforming to Cold War orthodoxy. Once in office, their management of the Vietnam War reflected the preferences of the national security bureaucracies, most formidably the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington and the headquarters of General Creighton Abrams in South Vietnam, Military Assistance Command Vietnam. Over time, their close reliance on the career military would weaken, but in the beginning, this was the expertise they trusted. Moreover, despite the sobering experience of the 1968 Tet Offensive, at the outset of the administration, there were no high-level voices within the executive branch pressing for a rapid end to the war. Within the State Department, there was a lively interest in peace negotiations, but the advocates of diplomacy retained the hope that an independent, non-communist South Vietnam would emerge. Given that elusive objective, its members were held hostage to the imperatives of war fighting. While illuminating the forces that propelled Nixon's and Kissinger's military measures forward, including an expansion of the U.S. effort in Cambodia and Laos, Fire and Rain also examines the limitations imposed by public opinion and the organized peace movement. The narrowness of his 1968 electoral victory weighed heavily upon Richard Nixon, as did the political demise of his predecessor, Lyndon Johnson. Throughout his first term, Nixon was plainly frustrated and angered by anti-war protest, while at the time the impact of that protest on administration policy was ambiguous. However, decades of declassified records provide evidence that the waves of mass demonstrations, accompanied by growing resistance inside the military, ongoing electoral activity, and lobbying efforts on Capitol Hill, impose significant constraints on presidential decision-making. The ensuing narrative pays considerable attention to the pivotal role played by Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird. To the outside world, he appeared to be another hawk in the administration's leadership circle. But behind the scenes, he was a relentless advocate of U.S. troop withdrawals. Unlike other national security colleagues, Laird was first and foremost a politician. A reluctant appointee, he had served in the Congress for 16 years and was, at the time of his selection, chairing the House Republican Conference. Although conservative in outlook, he was also keenly attuned to the mood of the public and was convinced that without major steps to exit the war, the president and his party would pay a steep political price. To tell this story from the hallways of power in Washington, D.C., as
Sample complete. Ready to continue?